rejected the charges against me that were filed by a federal judge, who then appointed a private law firm that had Chevron as a client. And that was my prosecutor, which explains this extraordinary length of detention for a misdemeanor. You know, I was in detention 993 days for a misdemeanor crime. I assert my innocence, but even if I were guilty, the maximum sentence is 180 days. So why was I in for 993 days? So there were a lot of irregularities here that we plan to challenge and try to correct. But ultimately, this was really about a corporate capture, I believe, of an element of our federal judiciary in retaliation for my work. And, you know, that's a playbook that I think the industry, the fossil fuel industry, that is, plans to continue to use against lawyers and activists who are a little too successful in challenging this industry.
Stephen, we're going to have to leave it there because we've come to the end of the show and the end of your Zoom capacity, it sounds like. Stephen Danziger is a human rights lawyer who successfully sued Chevron in Ecuador for dumping oil and toxic waste in the Amazon, just off house arrest after nearly 1,000 days. Democracy Now! Has an immediate job opening for a news writer producer. Check out democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.
On 90.7 FM.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, today is the last day to register to vote or change your party affiliation before Oregon's May primary. A Portland State University report finds that the Portland Street Response Team was successful in its first year. And in international news, the U.S. pushes for military aid for Ukraine from NATO as Russia warns of the possibility of World War III. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 26, 2022. KBOO is currently in our spring membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Today is the last day for Oregonians to register to vote or change party affiliation before the May primary. KBOO's Josh Salem has more on the story.
Today marks the last day for a number of deadlines related to the May 17th primaries. Tuesday is the registration deadline for new Oregonians, or those who have never registered before. It is also the last day to register with a political party or change party affiliation. Oregonians are automatically registered to vote when they get a driver's license, permit, or ID card from the DMV. If they do nothing further, they are registered as an unaffiliated voter, someone not associated with any political party. Voters get postcards in the mail. They can use that postcard to choose a party by selecting an affiliation and mailing it back. They can also use that card to opt out of registering to vote at all. In Washington, candidates are all put on the same primary ballot regardless of party affiliation, and the top two advance to the November general election. Oregon, however, has closed primaries, which means one has to register with a party in order to vote in a specific contest. Thus, if one wants to vote for the Democratic or Republican candidates running for governor in the May primaries, they must be registered to vote as a Democrat or Republican before the party change deadline today. Voters who don't register with a major party receive a non-affiliated ballot, which will include candidates for local, nonpartisan offices such as county commissioners, city officials, and judges. They can also participate in any measures up for voting in May. But partisan seats like federal and state legislators and the governor will not be included. People looking to register or change their party affiliation by the deadline can register online or print a registration card and mail it in. Voters can register online through OregonVotes.gov until 11:59 p.m. today. They must have an Oregon DMV card, such as a driver's license, a permit, or an ID card to register online. People who don't have a state-issued ID or who would prefer to use paper can print out a voter registration card online and mail it in. Mailed registration cards need to be postmarked on or before April 26th to count. Ballots can be mailed on or before Election Day, as long as they are postmarked May 17th or earlier. They must be received within a week from Election Day. People preferring to drop their ballots off need to get them to an official ballot drop-off location by 8 p.m. on Election Day. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
A new report from Portland State University researchers concluded that the Portland Street Response Team has demonstrated success in meeting the needs it was created to address and recommended that the program be expanded citywide. The team was created under the umbrella of Portland Fire and Rescue's Community Health Division and was designed to provide an unarmed response to nonviolent behavioral and mental health calls, dispatching a small team that includes crisis counselors and paramedics instead of police. PSU's Homelessness Research and Action Collaborative was asked to evaluate the program for its overall effectiveness while providing suggestions for ways that it could be improved and expanded citywide. According to the PSU report, the street response team accounted for a roughly 4% reduction in total calls traditionally responded to by police for areas in which it operated. This meant a 27% reduction in police responses for non-emergency welfare checks and unwanted persons calls. Only 3.2% of all calls handled by the street response team ended with a client being brought to a hospital, and none of them resulted in an arrest. Despite recommending the program's expansion citywide, the PSU report notes that the team faces headwinds. The researchers found that many people in underserved communities registered significant concerns about calling 911, which is currently the way that the team is dispatched, or they had difficulty reaching a dispatcher when they tried. At the same time, the report noted that dispatchers might not be fully aware of which calls should be routed to the street response team rather than police or fire. Many people in the community that researchers spoke with were also unaware of the team, particularly in communities of color, though awareness has grown over time. While the team showed effectiveness in meeting the immediate needs of clients during a call, the report also noted gaping holes in the continuity of care, so that clients could continue getting what they needed. Both police and street response staff also expressed some frustrations with the limits on the kind of calls the team could take. The team is not allowed to respond to calls inside private residences, calls that involve suicide, or calls where the client is standing in the street. PSU's report strongly recommended that the program not only be expanded throughout the city and through all hours of the day, but to include a wider array of calls involving serious mental health crises. City officials announced at the end of last month that the Portland Street Response Program would be expanded to cover the entire city, which agrees with the primary recommendation of the PSU report. Oregon relies on nurses from other states for its healthcare system, particularly in rural areas. If the numbers of those nurses start to fall, a new report says it would hurt rural communities in the state the most. Joel Schomburg has more on the story.
A new report finds Oregon's healthcare system is vulnerable to shortages if trends change in the field of nursing. The Oregon Center for Nursing compared people in the profession who are licensed through examination versus those who receive endorsements. Nurses licensed by exam typically are from within the state, whereas nurses with endorsed licenses come from out of state. The number of endorsed nurses has risen significantly in recent years. Jana Bitten, who heads the Oregon Center for Nursing, says the trends will have to continue to support some parts of the state's healthcare system.
If there are endorsing nurses who don't migrate into the state at the same rate that they have been migrating in before, that means that there is going to be an increase in shortages in some of those areas that are in our rural parts of the state and also places that are outside of a hospital.
Bitten notes this analysis uses data from before the pandemic, and it's not yet clear how COVID-19 has affected these trends. She says a nursing shortage would mean longer waits to access care and delaying or canceling elective surgeries. Bitten says it's important to find ways to encourage out-of-state nurses to stay in Oregon.
That involves having communities working together in partnership with their government, with their hospitals, with their schools, and just everyone in the community to band together, work collaboratively to make sure that we have the nursing workforce and the healthcare system that we need.
She says increasing access to education is also important and something her organization has worked on. She says the state and communities need to ensure there's enough faculty at nursing schools, as well as enough training and learning opportunities to accommodate students. For KBOO News and the Oregon News Service, I'm Joel Schomburg.
The U.S. on Tuesday urged allies to further increase support for Ukraine after Russia warned of the danger of World War III. Moscow's top diplomat said that the threat of nuclear war should not be underestimated and added that Western weapons shipments were legitimate targets. This comes after Russia accused NATO of having effectively, quote, entered into a war with Russia through proxies, end quote. Officials in Poland and Bulgaria said Russia is suspending their country's natural gas deliveries starting Wednesday. The governments of the two European countries said that Russian energy giant Gazprom informed them Tuesday it would be halting gas supplies. Europe imports large amounts of Russian natural gas to heat homes, generate electricity, and fuel industry. The imports have continued despite the war in Ukraine. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said Tuesday that Russia had failed in its mission to eliminate Ukrainian sovereignty. Blinken said Washington has approved a $165 million sale of ammunition to Ukraine and will also provide more than $300 million in financing to buy more supplies. U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said that while the U.S. wants to see Ukraine remain a sovereign democratic country, it also wants, quote, to see Russia weaken to the point where it can't do things like invade Ukraine, end quote. Austin's comments about weakening Russia appeared to represent a shift in broader U.S. strategic goals. Previously, the U.S. position had been that the goal of American military aid was to help Ukraine win and to defend Ukraine's NATO neighbors against Russian threats. When Russia invaded Ukraine on February 24th, its apparent goal was the quick capture of the capital of Kyiv. But the Ukrainians, with the help of Western weapons, have pushed back and forced President Vladimir Putin's troops to retreat. Moscow now says its goal is to take the Donbass, the mostly Russian-speaking industrial region in eastern Ukraine. While both sides say the campaign in the east is underway, Russia has yet to mount an all-out ground offensive and has not achieved any major victories. Officials in the Ukrainian port city of Mariupol said a new mass grave has been identified about 6 miles north of the city. It is at least the third new mass grave discovered in Russian-controlled areas in the last week. The UN said Tuesday that around 7.7 million people remain displaced inside Ukraine, while another 13 million are estimated to be stranded in affected areas and unable to leave because of security risks. Of those who have been forced to flee their homes, 90% are women and children. You're listening to a spring membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for Totality of Circumstances with KBOO's Sam Bowman and Jasmine Moneymaker. Then at 6, it's Preference. And at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of 44 degrees. Tomorrow will be partly cloudy with a high of 58 degrees. Today in history, in 1986, the world's worst nuclear power plant accident occurs at the Chernobyl nuclear power station in the Soviet Union. 32 people died and dozens more suffered radiation burns in the first days of the crisis. But only after Swedish officials reported the fallout did Soviet authorities reluctantly admit that an accident had occurred. The radiation that escaped into the atmosphere was spread by the wind over northern and eastern Europe, contaminating millions of acres of forest and farmland. An estimated 5,000 Soviet citizens eventually died from cancer and other radiation-induced illnesses caused by their exposure, and millions more had their health adversely affected. The quote of the day is from American author, activist, and civil rights leader Coretta Scott King, who said, quote, "Hate is too great a burden to bear. It injures the hater more than it injures the hated." The Supreme Court considers Remain in Mexico. A federal judge blocks the end of Title 42, and the White House mulls regulatory action after Elon Musk buys Twitter. With more on the story, it's Mary Sherman with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Migrant families flee from their countries, flee from the harsh conditions, and embark in a life-threatening journey.
The Supreme Court hears oral arguments today on the future of the Trump-era Remain in Mexico policy, which Marco Castillo with immigration advocacy organization Global Exchange says violated human rights. President Joe Biden reversed the 2019 policy, which forced people seeking asylum to await their court dates in Mexico, but lower courts reinstated it. Gene Hamilton, a Homeland Security official during the Trump administration, claims the policy is humanitarian.
Eliminating that program created a huge magnet, a huge pull factor for smugglers to be able to start targeting the populations for whom the administration has the most difficulty removing, and that's people who come with children.
Meanwhile, Title 42 will remain in place for now. A federal judge granted a temporary motion to prevent the White House from carrying out its planned May 23rd end of the emergency COVID-related border restriction, which allowed officials to quickly expel migrants. Following a meeting with Ukraine's president in Kiev, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said he believes Russia is failing in its incursion.
We want to see Russia weakened to the degree that it can't do the kinds of things that it has done in invading Ukraine. So it has already lost a lot of military capability and a lot of its troops, quite frankly.
The U.S. is preparing more than $322 million in foreign military financing to help Ukraine purchase weapons directly from manufacturers. A bipartisan group of lawmakers reforming the 135-year-old Electoral Count Act meets today. Maine Senator Susan Collins says they've made progress, including codifying the vice president's role in electoral vote counting. Democrats want to include Voting Rights Act provisions, which Collins worries could kill the bill. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis approved the creation of a new standalone election police force. It comes after a flurry of voting restriction laws passed in red states following false claims the 2020 presidential election was stolen. Twitter says it's accepted Elon Musk's $44 billion offer to take the company private. The Tesla CEO says he wants to bolster free speech on the platform. At the White House, Press Secretary Jen Psaki did not comment directly on the news, but indicated Twitter could face regulatory action in the future.
There are also reforms that we think Congress could take, and we would support taking, including reforming Section 230, enacting antitrust reforms, requiring more transparency.
And former President Donald Trump was held in contempt of court over a New York investigation into his business dealings. Trump must pay $10,000 a day until he complies, providing requested financial documents. His attorney argued all relevant documents were already submitted. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our eight trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The Supreme Court declines to intervene in a case over Alaska's authority to regulate off-reservation fishing. Wisconsin is the latest state to create an Office of Environmental Justice. And the Indian Health Service receives $5 million in federal funding to help eliminate HIV and hepatitis C in Indian country. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The U.S. Supreme Court declined to intervene Monday in a case over Alaska's authority to regulate off-reservation fishing. The legal fight centered on a Metlakatla man charged with illegally fishing in waters just outside the reservation's marine boundaries. But as KRBD's Eric Stone reports, it's not the end of the line for the tribe's legal efforts to exempt Metlakatla fishermen from state regulations.
Metlakatla tribal member John Scudero Jr. was fishing for coho salmon near his home on Annette Island south of Ketchikan when he was picked up by the Coast Guard. He was charged with illegal fishing. Scudero didn't have a permit to fish in state waters outside the boundaries of Alaska's only native reservation. He was convicted and fined $20,000. Scudero took his case to the Alaska Supreme Court. He argued the state didn't have the authority to prevent him from fishing in traditional territory of his tribe. It's part of a long-running dispute between Metlakatla tribal members and state authorities.
We've been a fishing tribe for the last 120 years, and we continue to fish.
The 1891 law that created the Annette Islands Reserve guaranteed the tribe a self-sustaining home, and Metlakatla Indian community members like Scudero argue that the tribe can't sustain itself without fishing in areas near Ketchikan and Prince of Wales Island outside the reservation's boundaries. Michigan State University law professor Matthew Fletcher says Scudero's case is far from the last word. The tribe itself, Metlakatla Indian community, has a similar case pending in the federal Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, which challenges the state's right to regulate tribal members fishing outside the reservation.
As a general matter, it is very much a better vehicle to review these questions.
State attorneys argued late last year that holding Metlakatla tribal members to the state's fishing permit system is essential to maintaining sustainable wild salmon runs. Fletcher says that case could have far-reaching consequences for tribes in Alaska and up and down the West Coast under the court's jurisdiction. A decision in the tribe's Ninth Circuit case is expected later this year. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Eric Stone.
Wisconsin has become the latest state to create an Office of Environmental Justice. Chuck Kornbach of station WUWM reports on what that might mean for Native communities.
About 15 states have set up an office or commission focused on ways to protect overburdened communities or communities that face disproportionate exposure to environmental hazards. Wisconsin Democratic Governor Tony Evers has just signed an executive order creating an environmental justice office to advise him, after Republican legislators failed to go along with the idea. Following a signing ceremony at the Indian Community School near Milwaukee, Evers said floods and other problems along waterways have harmed Wisconsin tribes. He says some tribal leaders have responded by creating wetlands and other controls, but Evers says the state has a role too.
We need to help them make sure that their infrastructure is sound and that we can help them keep it that way.
Jason Dropic is head of school at the Indian Community School and is a member of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe. He says it's good that governors are promising to hear from more diverse voices.
As both a tribal member and someone who grew up in an urban American Indian population, we just know that often those perspectives are just left out.
Dropic says he's also glad his students got to hear that a state leader is promising to think about future generations. He says he'll believe the promises as long as he sees work to support environmental justice. For National Native News, I'm Chuck Kornbach.
The Indian Health Service announced Monday it received $5 million in federal funding to work to eliminate HIV and hepatitis C in Indian country. The funding will support training, infrastructure, and media campaigns. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Member-owned co-ops provide electricity in many rural areas, but rural electric co-ops face barriers to going renewable. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Across much of rural America, electricity is provided by member-owned utility co-ops. They tend to be small, often serving just a few thousand customers.
Electric co-ops are in the heartland of America, making communities work where you may not have ready access to everything you get in a big city.
Jill Clyburn is president of Clyburn & Associates, a New Mexico-based consultancy. Her group has been working to help rural utility co-ops use more solar energy and battery storage. She says rural utility co-ops often lack the capacity and knowledge needed to start new projects.
They have boards of directors, which are very capable people in the community, but they come from a variety of backgrounds. So they may not be engineers, they may be somebody from the school district, somebody from a private business.
so her team has been creating online resources that introduce rural co-ops to how the clean energy industry works and guide them through the initial steps of planning and purchasing. She says rural America's wide open spaces are ideal for generating wind and solar electricity, so she wants to make sure rural communities benefit from the transition to clean energy. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
The war in Ukraine is poisoning the nation's air, water, and soil. On top of the crushing toll of thousands of lives lost in the conflict, experts are concerned about the environmental and health effects of exposure to heavy metals and to toxic gases and particulates from explosions, fires, and building collapses. The potential environmental and health impacts could reach beyond Ukraine's borders as the pollutants are carried downwind and downstream. Now we go to global citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
It's been said before, but bears repeating. War and preparation for war are the number one threats to the environment. Think of the Cold War's legacy in Europe, especially Eastern Europe. Heavily polluted industrial cities, poisoned soil wherever military bases stood, damaged forests, poor public health. The Ukraine war is already having a major impact on the environment, affecting agricultural output, air and land quality, energy policy around the world, and of course, public health. Russia's invasion could not have come at a worse time. Just months after the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, released another report, this one completed in fall of 2021, that once again showed how far governments have to go to have any chance to protect the planet from intolerable warming. The United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres says inflation is rising and the war in Ukraine is causing food and energy prices to skyrocket. But increasing fossil fuel production will only make matters worse. The push in the United States for more domestic production with a giant prod from big oil is certainly helping make matters worse, as I said in a recent broadcast. Many in Europe, starting with Germany, remain wedded to Russian gas and coal. Their governments and ours pretend to be attacking climate change when, in fact, their main worry is public opinion and the next election. Consequently, to quote the Secretary General again, and he's someone who doesn't mince words, they are, quote, saying one thing but doing another. Simply put, they are lying, and the results will be catastrophic. As for the environment, the latest IPCC report summarizes the environmental situation for Europe before the war in Ukraine. Risks to people, economies, and infrastructures due to coastal and inland flooding. Stress and mortality to people due to increasing temperatures and heat extremes. Marine and terrestrial ecosystems disruptions. Water scarcity to multiple interconnected sectors. Losses in crop production due to compound heat and dry conditions and extreme weather. Needless to say, all those risks, especially to human life and food and water supplies, must now be multiplied as the war drags on. The refugee flow from Ukraine, mainly to Poland, will soon reach about one quarter of Ukraine's total population, about 4.4 million people. Added to the current 3.7 million refugees are another 6 million displaced persons inside Ukraine. The International Committee on the Red Cross says the refugee situation amounts to, quote, a catastrophic health crisis. The huge numbers are putting extraordinary pressure on public health facilities in Poland and elsewhere. Public health is also threatened by Russian bombing of hospitals, clinics, and nursing homes, among other civilian targets, and by possible radiation leakage from Ukraine's four nuclear power plants should they be captured by Russian forces. Also relevant is the crowded conditions for refugees as they travel, with increased possibility of contracting or spreading COVID. The war abroad intersects with the global environmental crisis and our responsibility to the planet. The U.S., with 5% of the world's population, consumes 24% of the world's energy. On a per-person basis, each American consumes roughly three times the energy of the average Chinese, and many more times if we're talking about people in low-income countries. More than three-quarters of U.S. energy comes from fossil fuels, and only 12.5% from renewable sources. While China now leads the way in carbon dioxide emissions, 27% of the world total, and is actually increasing coal production again, the U.S. accounts for about 11% of the global total. But, because of the war, is opening more public land to oil and gas drilling. In short, while we might again think about sacrificing by paying higher fuel prices, We're all actually doing precious little to be good global citizens and tightly embrace conservation and sustainability. When Janet Yellen, the Treasury Secretary, says, as she did the other day, that maximum pressure must be put on Russia, but only up to the point of economic inconvenience for Americans, we know that it's business as usual here. Fighting climate change is taking a backseat to fighting war, a fact that only the major oil companies can find heartening. Ukraine isn't our war, and it's far away, many people seem to think. But as Stevie Wonder sings, don't think you're in it, but not of it. I'm Mel Gertoff for The Global Citizen. Thanks very much for listening.
You're listening to a spring membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 26, 2022. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Mel Gertoff, Josh Salem, and Joel Schomburg. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Mary Sherman, Eric Tegedoff, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. All of these KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give. Or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Totality of Circumstances.
Thank you for listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is Totality of Circumstances, a monthly show about the intersections of police and community in Portland. My name is Sam.
And my name is Jasmine. This month, we're talking to Kay Rambo, editor-in-chief of the Street Roots newspaper. Street Roots is a weekly street paper focused on social and environmental justice issues and sold by vendors across the city.
Street Roots has recently consolidated its reporting on housing, homelessness, and homeless policy under a